Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World Thursday webinar on the 14th of May 2020. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Spencer Crooks, who's an ex-director of market making at Winterfloods, who's going to answer everything you've wanted to know about market making, but never been able to ask. Spencer, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure and good afternoon.
For those of the people out there that don't know you, could you give us a short overview of your background?
Yes, I started in the stock market in 1985, working for a company called Bisgood & Bishop. Bisgood was then taken over during Big Bang by County NatWest. And then in 1988, Brian Winterflood decided to leave County NatWest and set up a company called Winterflood Securities, which is where I worked for the next 30 years, being made a director of trading, or one of the directors of trading in 1999, and hanging up my boots not so long ago and leaving that to someone else to do.
How long ago did you leave?
I actually left the company in March 2017, but actually I was fully released in November 2018.
Excellent. So what do market makers do?
Market makers, prices, the opportunity for people or individuals, or their brokers, I should say, actually, and institutions to buy and sell securities.
So without them, it would be impossible to trade?
It wouldn't be impossible to trade, but it would be certainly a lot harder. And a lot costlier. Market makers provide liquidity, certainly in the smaller end of the market. Effectively, there's really two tiers of market. There's the very liquid security end, the FTSE 100 and the 250, and then you've got the smaller cap and the AIM market and some investment trusts. And those less liquid securities, a market maker is vital, I would say.
And for the smaller end of the market, which is where Winterflood started off, what's the business model? How do they make their money?
They simply make their money on the risk. Their Winterfloods, for example, are risking their capital and providing liquidity. So they make their money from the turn, the difference between the bid and the offer, buying and selling. Or in some cases, if institutions or big clients want to have a large order which they would like us to work previously, they would pay a commission. But effectively, in the smaller end, Winterfloods and other market makers, specialist market makers like Peel Hunt and N1 Singer, and there's a Numis, there's a big array. They make their money by basically risking their capital and the difference between buying and selling. Sadly, with smaller companies, due to the liquidity being reduced, there is often only sellers or only buyers, hence why the market makers are risking the capital and creating the liquidity to the market.
In some stocks, say there's been a profit warning and it's not a very attractive stock to hold, why would they want to be a buyer when everybody else wants to sell it?
They probably don't want to be a buyer, but the ethos of Winterfloods always has been and still is making a two-way price to buy and sell. So effectively, the market maker, when he if a company has a profits warning or in the opposite, a bid situation, they are trying to gauge the level where there is that two-way demand. So if there is a profits warning, the trader will quickly read the statement, analyze what it will possibly do to that company, and then call that price to the level which he thinks justify the statement that has been made. So with market makers in certainly the smaller cap arena, they've got on average about 15, 16 years experience. And that experience is vital.
And do they stop making a market if they've called it wrong and they've bought too much? Do they stop making a market? What happens if they've got it wrong?
If they've got it wrong, they lose money. Simple as that. And like all things, there is no crystal ball. They do get it wrong. And it's finding that level where there is institutional or retail interest where they think at this price it's justifies that sort of chance or risk of buying. You know, when I was trading smaller cap, I was asked to set up the FTSE desk in 2001. But when I was doing smaller caps, sometimes you would have companies go bust on you. And incredibly, it would be rather expensive. Everyone has this view that the market maker has the inside track. They sadly certainly don't. Used to be, whenever there was a bid, 8 times out of 10, we'd be taken out of stock beforehand. And if there was a profit warning, would have been sold stock just before the profit warning. So in that respect, the option, though, for the market maker is to trade, or what's known as job his way out of it. In other words, do enough volume, enough business that he actually can make back the loss through buying and selling.
But does the market ever cease because the risk level has been exceeded that they want to get involved in on that stock? So no one's going to trade it. How does it work?
The market might go into an auction due to the percentage movement, but some market makers can obviously with tracked their electronic price if they decided for the RSP, which is the retail service provider. So electronically to brokers, for example, like Halifax or AJ Bell or Hargreaves Lansdown, they can turn their electronic machine off if they so desire. Certainly Winterflood never used to. And I live to believe that's still the case now. They offer two-way liquidity. And then the broker might decide only to take phone, or the market maker might decide only to take phone calls. But generally, you want the flow. The flow you want, because that's your opportunity to, quote, trade your way out of the situation.
And on a normal stock, you've not had a profit warning. How is the spread determined? Because that's where a market maker makes their money. So how do you determine what that spread is?
Today, sadly, it's determined by the London Stock Exchange. The London Stock Exchange obviously has the electronic order book. So that the spread is determined by them. The more liquid securities, for example, in the FTSE 100, depending on the share price, there's certain bands. So depending on the share price, whether it's £1 or £10, it has a different percentage spread. But then effectively what happens, the market maker will give an electronic price around that price. And invariably, 98% of the time, the market maker will improve on that electronic order book price. So the client actually benefits, because if they had to deal, or if they have to ask their broker to deal on that order book, it would be far more expensive than dealing for free with the market maker, because to execute a trade on the order book, the lovely London Stock Exchange charges money to execute an order, to hit an order or take an order, be an aggressor. But if you deal with a market maker via the RSP engine or the electronic engine, it's free. So that's why firms, for example, the larger firms like Barclays and Halifax and Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell can charge £9.95 or £12.95 or whatever that is, because the market maker is providing that service, and that's providing that service for free. Also, the market maker is giving the other benefit of flexibility of settlement. That's the other added advantage the market maker is giving.
And in terms of market size, how is the minimum market size or electronic market size set?
Well, that's, again, set by the LSE. But again, the market maker, more often than not, gives far greater liquidity. Again, it depends what's in free float, and it depends, it's on a stock-by-stock basis. It varies, as obviously the more liquid the security, the larger the size. A market maker really depends on liquidity, on volume. Now, the broker can decide who he deals with. What wins is simply best price and best volume, quite frankly, or the market maker that makes the best bid or the cheapest offer with the biggest size wins the deal. It's as simple as that. It's dog eat dog. It's not the fact of anything else. So the market maker, really, it has to be good. He has to know what he's doing. Certainly in the smaller cap arena as well, because there is less liquidity. And as you pointed out earlier, he can, if he doesn't know his stocks well, get himself in a pickle, and which will cost the firm or the book or him dear.
And with the market size, I thought it was a sort of legal stipulation of the LSE that you had to offer the minimum market size.
Correct.
But sometimes you have a trade that won't go through, you can't buy it or you can't sell any. It doesn't matter how small you go.
Well, that probably might be due to an auction, or there's an announcement. I mean, if there's an announcement, it's obviously sensible for the market maker to momentarily suspend the electronic trading engine while he reads a statement, because obviously someone, heaven forbid, might have an idea that a statement's coming out, or might have read the statement before the market maker. Or bless him, the market maker might be going to the restroom. So, that would be probably the only situation where it's suspended momentarily during mandatory trading hours, just simply because there's an announcement out, an RNS, and they want to read it.
And what's a tree shake?
Tree shake. Well, I can only imagine what tree shake is, but a tree shake is where effectively a stock has had a very, very good, long, sustained run during the day, maybe up 20, 50, 100%, whatever the case may be. And there may be some day traders, and the market maker is just cools them down to see if there are any loose holders. Because a lot of people, some day traders, I would imagine, not that I know, but I would imagine momentum trade. And so as soon as there's a down tick, they possibly decide to take their profits. So I would imagine a tree shake is simply basically when they see the stock change momentum or stop on the upward path and come down and down again and down again after several moves. They decide this is the tree shake, and they decided to lock in their profit or sell their security.
And what's the motive for a market maker to elicit a tree shake?
Well, I would only think he might be short of the stock lower down. He might just see if there, he might want to buy the stock because just see if there's any loose holders. It could be any number of things, but in today's world, it's very well regulated. Everything's very transparent. It's a very, very, crystal clear system. So that's the only thing I could imagine is he decides that they've actually run too far. And let's see if there's any loose holders. Again, the person who electronically is indicating the best bid will be the person who gets the security. So whatever market maker has gone on the offer or called them down or ticked them easier doesn't necessarily mean that market maker will gain the stock. It is who is making the best price and the best size wins the deal. You're only good as your last trade.
Interesting. So at the opposite end, when there's a profit warning, what's happening for the market maker then?
In When it's a profits warning, in what respect? In other words,
if you have before the market opens, you read mm-hmm. one of these sort of stomach sinking RNSs that
I've had a few of those over my years.
You go, oh no, this isn't good. What's happening for the market maker at that point? How do they know that they're going to mark it down by how much?
Again, reading the statement, there's often indications that if the statement comes out pre market hours, you there's indications given. Again, it depends on the security. The more liquid securities, they're covered by analysts, sadly, at the lower end of the market. Some of the AIM stocks and the smaller cap companies aren't covered so well by analysts. So the market maker will read that statement. And he will basically think, well, I think there'll be X on open. And effectively, then they tend to go into an auction. And he'll have the chance to, if he thinks that uncrossing price is correct or incorrect, have the chance to get involved in that uncrossing price. He might decide to sell his book if he's got some at the higher level. He might decide to buy some. Again, he has to anticipate retail flow, because certain stocks obviously have a brand following. For example, in the recent capitulation we've had, I would imagine a lot of retail clients would have bought Royal Dutch Shell and BP. Why? Brand names, historically good dividends, good dividend payers. You know, oil's been routed, but will it survive? Yes. So at these levels, they might think, well, I'll put them into my ISA or my SIP, and on a 5-year view or 3-year view or 3-month view, they're worth holding, where a day trader might have a different view or aspect of that.
And in setting the price after the profit warning, before the market's open, what's happening with that auction? What insight is happening for the market maker in that pre-market 10 minutes?
Well, all orders are being loaded, bid and offer.
Are coming from brokers?
Institutions. It could be, it could be any number. It could be hedge funds who are looking to close bears, looking to open bears. There's so many instruments in today's new world. For example, ETFs, exchange traded funds, baskets of oil stocks or oil ETFs, they might be looking to unravel, where funds want to have exposure to an oil ETF. Well, to get exposure to an oil ETF, they have to create, and creating that might be buying the basket of oil companies in the FTSE 100 or whatever the case may be. Obviously, ETFs are different. So there's so many different instruments now, where back in the old days when we were on the floor of the London Stock Exchange and we had our ledgers, there weren't so many instruments and there weren't the algorithmic trading engines. So one never really knows. Obviously, there's spread betting, CFDs. There's so many different instruments. So I don't think you overanalyze that, where it's coming from. It's more what do you see there? What's the volume? Because trading highly liquid stocks, for example, like the BPs or the Shell, the volumes of shares that are traded are vast now.
Mm. And moving on to the recent past with the COVID market decline, what would have been happening for the market maker with, the market collapse by 30%? What's happening at his end? Is it good because of the volatility?
He probably had his tin hat on. He was sitting under his desk, if he had any sense. As it was going down a lift shaft for 3, 4, 5 days consecutively. I would say, like all things, it's finding the levels, isn't it? I mean, the market is run by two aspects, fear and greed. And certainly there was probably an immense amount of fear going on until the government's intervention in late March. The market overreacts on the upside or the downside. So, those with cash who, again, knew what they were doing, or those fund managers very shrewdly who had stocks on their watch page. I noticed that Nick Train and Terry Smith both sort of delved into Fevertree at sort of the £10 level. They go shopping and they take advantage of the market, because I think when the market does sort of have that knee-jerk reaction like it did, where everything is almost in free fall, there are opportunities to have. But the market maker has, certainly all the market makers, they have their set number of stocks. And because of their knowledge of 15, 16, 17 years, certainly that was the case at Winterfloods, they know those companies very well. They know those companies that have no debt, cash on their book, or even the companies that are highly leveraged that they know will possibly struggle to get out of the situation. So for them, they have a cash allocation. It's for them to decide where they want to allocate that cash, because obviously trades are coming in constantly electronically. And then also they have the larger trades that might be institutional, or even the larger trades that might be brokers. So the market maker that time is snowed under with tapping his screen, changing the prices, monitoring the flow of stock that's coming in or even off his book, who's buying, who's selling to him, and also limits from brokers or institutions where they previously have indicated they would like to be offered stock. So for a market maker, he has a lot to digest over a very short period of time.
But the volatility is good for the market maker. Their figures commercially are going to be good during that period.
Well, I think volume's the key thing as well. Volatility, you need movement, certainly. But the key is volume. And I think looking at Hargreaves Lansdown's figures this morning, they said that the volume is up substantially. So I would say after the initial carnage that happened, the 5 or 6 down days where it looked like the world was ending, the volumes have now, people had time to absorb some of the information that's been thrown at them, the huge government interaction globally, and then seeing, right, what is cheap. I know I was speaking to someone the other day that in April 2019, £100 million was raised, where in April 2020, over £3 billion has been raised. So a lot of companies have come into the market to shore up their balance sheet, which has created opportunities. And the fact that the volume is there is obviously very, very good for the market maker. It's no good having a highly volatile situation where there's no trade. That makes sense. It's a bit like the coronavirus created with loo rolls. It's all very well for Sainsbury's, but if they haven't got anything to sell, it's no good. So it's a very simple thing as well. If no one's buying on selling, for a market maker, it's no good. They want liquidity. The other thing as well with market makers, which is people must remember, they're not investors. It's the Nick Trains and the Terry Smiths of the world that looking to buy and hold and stick them away for years to come. Market makers, they're literally apples and pears. They trade, it's the next one. They're simply looking for turnover.
So, Spencer, from your days as a market maker, what are you looking for to get the best price on a deal today? How are you judging price and volume?
Well, I think it comes down... It's like all things in life. It's not what you know, it's who you know. So it's relationships. So I think my brokers have got a wealth of knowledge. They know the markets very well, and they've got a real expertise. They may not be the most, the cheapest, but you gain that back immensely by the prices they trade at. They've got a very good relationship with the market makers. So basically, I'm looking for their skill and their flow and their ability to trade at very, very good prices. So that's what I'm looking for, and that's what I do in today's. I'm obviously no longer trading. I'm a simple investor that sort of buys and holds and puts them in my bottom drawer. And hopefully one day they're good companies and they go from strength to strength. And having the benefit of being a market maker, there's certain brokers you know and respect and better than others, shall we say, and then you've just got that relationship with them, that trust. And I think, you know, market makers are key, really key. They provide an excellent service and it enables the broker to do his business. I know James Sharp, I spoke to him the other day, and he commented on how certainly Winterflood provided throughout the whole carnage a two-way price, certainly to them. And, you know, he actually called me to tell me that, which was very kind of him. But, you know, that's what I look for, a very good broker who brings added value.
Very good. Now, I'm going to open up for questions, which we've had a few more coming in. I've got a question here from Paul Whiting, who asks, how do different market makers agree on a price for the same stock?
They might have the same limits. They might have, if they've both got the same price, which is, you know, they might not have any particular business in it. They might have, they might be passive in it. Or just by sheer fluke, they actually might be just making the same price. If they are making the same price, what tends to happen with from the broker's aspect, they tend to used to split the trade. So if there's two market makers making the same price electronically, that the trades would be split to give an equal percentage to each market maker. Some market makers, obviously Winterflood's being a good example, used to have a quite a high percentage simply because Winterflood used to make the best price and size. So hence it used to do more business, which actually caused some brokers, compliance officers, problems. But it just so happens, or there might be an order which is known to the market, which sometimes also happens. So a institution might go to, if there's only two market makers, it might say to both market makers, look, I'm looking to buy this security or sell this security at X. So hence they're both making the same price because they've both got the same limit. That's another possibility.
And we've got a question from James Coulson, who asks, are there any hints on the best time of day to trade? I understand that spreads can be at their widest before 9 a.m.
Well, obviously the market opens at 8. Again, it does vary on the liquidity of the security in question. I would say certainly it can work to your advantage if you are an early bird and deal just after 8 a.m. But you've got to sometimes that the price might go to your say advantage. It might be slightly higher than the market was anticipating. You can get out of some stocks. But I would say generally the closing of the business is when more volume tends to be done. So sort of between 4:30. The reason for that is obviously America used to click in at 2:30. So the business used to sort of formulate the busiest time was say 9 till 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then it would taper off between 11:30 and 2, and then you'd have America waking up and coming into the equation, and then there'd be another bout of volume, basically 2:30 to the close 4:30, but certainly 3:30 to 4:30. Probably the tightest prices and the bigger the volume.
I've now got a question from Mark Jackson, and he asks, for so-called market maker stocks, such as those in the SETSQX segments, I notice very occasionally there are lots of rather small trades going through simultaneously. And he gives an example for SLP, where there were tiny volumes, sort of 10, 200, 100, and that trades at about 40p a share. Who's placing these trades? Is it a spread betting firm?
Could be. It could be, or it could be, say, it could be one of the big, it could be Hargreaves or AJ Bell. It could be investment of money. It could be any number of things. It certainly wouldn't be for something like that. It wouldn't be an algo machine. So it just basically, maybe it's due to an EIS, former EIS stock that they've got those sort of weird shapes, or maybe it was an investment of money at the high level and they're crystallizing the loss, or can be any number of things. But certainly they used to happen, these sort of same prints and size used to happen in the highly liquid stocks, where you would have exactly the same shape, which would go through multiple times. I remember on one occasion that I had the same size go through 15,000 times in one stock some years ago. And it was just, you know, this quant working out they wanted to buy 5,555 shares, and it went through 15,000 times. So why they didn't actually do one transaction, it would save them a fortune. But there we go. So they're weird and wonderful, but for something 55 or 100 shares or whatever, I don't think there's anything untoward in there.
Paul Whittingham asked the question, which I think we've covered off a little, but it's probably worth giving clarity. Do market makers actually own or hold any stock, or do they just move stock on? It would be quite nice to know the clarity if there is a difference that they do both. What's the delineation between the two?
So in the smaller end, AIM, small cap, certainly some investment trusts and some illiquid bonds. Basically, there is no out. That out is the market maker. So the market maker holds inventory. Basically, there are no buyers or there are no sellers. So that's the importance of the market maker. That market maker is providing liquidity. In the larger stocks, the FTSE 100 and some 250s, not all 250s, there is enough liquidity, and at the end of the day, the market maker can level off his position in the closing auction. So there's enough free liquidity for the market maker to hold those positions. But certainly in the small cap AIM, without a doubt, he will be holding position. Possibly not through his choice. It might be some institution that has a new fund manager's come in. For example, when Mr. Woodford decided to move from Invesco, or even a new fund manager takes over, he has that time to clear out the portfolio that he's taken over, and say if it's in the smaller cap area, he decides to sell X holding of a stock. And a market maker will put up or be asked to put up a bid for that entire holding. And he prices it at a level where he thinks there will be some interest, and he gets that stock and he is left with the residue. And that residue can be with that market maker for months, could be even longer than that, sadly. Ideally, in a perfect world, the market maker would love to buy and sell and go home with a level book, but that is almost non-existent.
How long is the longest that you've known a residue stick around for?
Years. Years. Yeah, I used to get a report. You get a detailed report of how long everything had been on the books for. So you in today's world, it's lovely you could monitor absolutely everything. But I mean, some securities, I mean, don't forget you've got shares like Arsenal Football Club, and they used to deal in one share a time. And, some securities were very infrequently traded.
Nilesh Shukla asks, good afternoon. Any advice on buying and selling larger positions in illiquid stocks?
I would say probably. This is getting down to the quality of your broker, but sometimes it's better to drip feed and do it over a period of time. Sometimes it's better to do it in one hit. It varies per stock. If you've got a very good relationship with your broker, you can actually say, look, this is what I'm aiming to do. is there any appetite in the market for the stock or for that sort of position? And then his broker or broker can check the market and see, well, generally the market might trade in that sort of size, or no, it's far better to work the order over a period of time, which might be days, might be hours, it might be weeks. It all depends how illiquid that security is. What you don't want to do is spoil your own market, if that makes sense, by being too aggressive. So if they decide to set a specific price limit, then obviously they know that the market maker knows that that's the limit they're working to, and they can work with the client, which happened frequently, especially if it's a sensitive stock. The market maker works with the client, either broker, which is beneficial for the end client. It's a team, because with market makers, there's always tomorrow, and you're only good as your last trade, and you need that relationship with the broker, so the broker comes back to you. If the client's very unhappy, then obviously the broker isn't going to be happy with the market maker. So it works as a team. It's very much a team game. And I think it's quite sad how often the market maker, for some obscure reason, seems to get a very bad name, when actually they are risking their capital. And actually they are, you know, doing their utmost. And it's very, very good for the market. I remember having to do an Arrow interview with the FSA, and you know, the lady who was head of the department said, "Spencer, you know, we value wind and flood security so much because it's such a key cog instrument for the market, certainly in the smaller arena, because we provide such liquidity." I think in today's world of technology, certainly Winterflood had their own IT department, which is first class, which enabled the traders to make and never to have very rarely to have an outage. And that's providing an excellent service. Now, as far as the broker's concerned, you know, he would like his commission. If he can't trade, then obviously he's not going to get his commission. So it's a team game. It works. They work very well together. And I think all brokers and market makers there have some very good relationships, which benefits the client.
Our next question is from Lewis Robinson, who says, what's the downside to having an open, free order book-based trading system? Don't you think ordinary traders and institutions would provide liquidity in the small cap end of the market if market makers didn't have an effective monopoly?
No, you get increased volatility. You would get probably wouldn't be able to trade with the current sell-off that we've had due to the coronavirus. I would say you would see those orders disappear. So effectively, there would be no out. Or conversely, if there's a very positive news or a very good trading statement, they would have to formulate it around something. Well, what are they going to formulate that around? You know, the market maker is putting up a price, two-way price. The market maker, sometimes you must remember, is wrong. You know, he will buy stock and it goes down, and he'll buy some more and it goes down even more, because he's constantly buying stock electronically. On the format, the chap saying is, they possibly wouldn't even be there. There has to be a benchmark. There has to be someone to stand there and buy them. And in today's world, where it is algos, you probably find the reason the market cooks so hard on the upside or downside is due to these algos that are just momentum trading. So I would say in smaller caps, absolutely, categorically not. You probably have many securities which wouldn't have prices on there, or they'd only have offers and no bids.
And I've got a question here from Barry Smith, which is a two-part question. How much profits do market makers make per share traded and return on equity on their own book value?
Varies. I mean, or I must say, loss. you know, we don't get it right all the time. I can tell you many a time I did very well in losing money. Certainly in 1987, certainly in 2001, 2002, 2003, and certainly in 2008. There is no. Obviously, it depends. It depends on the volume. It depends on the situation. You might have a situation where there's a bid situation. There, for example, at the moment, the flavor of the month will be in stocks which are the biotech stocks. There could be a placing. There is no hard and fast answer to that question because it's changing daily. So it'd be lovely to say, well,
he's just chipped in and said on average.
It varies, and it varies by sector as well, as you can imagine. In 2008, for example, the FTSE was a lot busier than the smaller companies, and so it's constantly changing. It's impossible to say. I'm sorry to be not give a clear answer there, but it's too many moving objects. That's why the industry tends to have trading on a lower PE because of the volatility of earnings. For example, March probably P&L is totally different to April's P&L, if that makes sense.
Mm, absolutely, and March would be higher than April, or vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I've got a question here from Rebecca Stewart. And she said, "Hi, Spencer. As you said, market makers have got a bit of a bad reputation with investors. In particular, I hear they hunt stops that holders have set on their shares. Does this happen in your experience? And if not, where do you think this reputation comes from?"
I don't think market makers do. I mean, certainly... Because obviously, I would say 100% market makers don't, because that would be verging on market manipulation. And in today's world, that is illegal. And it's, as I said earlier, everything is so transparent. But what I would say, you might have some hedge funds know that there's some stops. So they might be constantly selling into the market to hit those stops. That is a possibility, but it's so well regulated in today's environment. No, that's not the case. I mean, market makers actually, and also market makers don't know what the stops are. The brokers might know what the stops are, or the hedge funds might have a guess of where the stops are, but no, I'd say that's not the case. The market makers, no, I'll put it this way, if it is, I'm unaware.
And I've got a question that's really across two people here. Dave Sullivan asks, when Leon was interviewed a couple of weeks ago, that he said he had a broker that he trusted and used when buying stock. In your view, is it better to pay a little more for a full service broker or to stick with the likes of AJ Bell or Hargreaves Lansdown, as they offer a pretty reasonably priced location for SIPs and ISAs? And then I want to go on to James Coulson, because it's the same theme, which is, why are charges higher for telephone dealing? Does it allow for pricing improvement, what with broker market maker relationships? So perhaps both of those could be answered together.
Yeah, well, I've got one of my sits with AJ Bell. I think they're very, very good. And I have also got an account with Redmayne Bentley and James Sharp. I think it's horses for courses. If I've got some large trades dealing in illiquid securities, I will place them with James Sharp or Redmayne Bentley, because I've got a long-standing relationship with them. And do I think it's worth paying more? 100%, yes, I do. I think you get a very advantageous price. I think it's also, they have a different model. Probably AJ Bell and Hargreaves Lansdown are sort of more retail investor focus, and are geared up electronically to deal with high volume, where certainly James Sharp are more bespoke, and they certainly gain a very good share price execution due to their relationship with market makers. And also the trades when I tend to deal with them are not executed via the market makers RSP, retail service provider, because, or their platform, is because it's larger, tends to be larger than that electronic trade. So yes, I would say horses are courses, but certainly I think you get what you pay for, and I think you get it back in spades.
And can you just clarify what the RSP is?
RSP is retail service provider. So effectively, it's where market makers provide that electronic execution trading platform. So brokers then can deal. There's, I don't know how many RSPs there are now. There used to be loads. But basically, where brokers can trade electronically in basically all instruments, varying on the stock, the size varies, the price improvement varies. It used to be the case that certainly over 90-95% price improvement on what was the LSE Touch. So it's certainly a massive advantage. It used to be the case that the improvement that was given by the market makers actually covered the costs of the broker executing the order. So the client really did benefit where, as I said earlier, if the client broker had to deal via the LSE on the order book, it would cost, that would be additional cost. And each fill on that order book would subsequently be an additional cost. So dealing with the market maker, not only do you get that execution free, but also you get a price improvement, which roughly used to equate to about £9.95 or £9.50. So effectively, if you're paying £9.95, you're getting your trade for free by the improvement that the market maker has given away. And that's the market maker giving that improvement away. That's that just benefiting the end client.
And a follow-up question to paying more for a full-service broker. Do the brokers mentioned provide SIPs and or ISAs?
The ones I mentioned? Yeah, I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. I don't know. James Sharp and Redmond Bentley certainly do ISAs without a doubt. I would imagine they definitely do SIPs as well.
Great. And Keith Jones asks, what are you doing now and how's it going?
What am I doing now? Well, leaving, I was very kindly asked to be join the committee of the Stock Exchange Benevolent Fund, which I very warmly accepted. And I was invited to be a non-exec director of a company called Skinny Tonic. And as of April, I became chairman of Skinny Tonic. So you can look it on the website. It's number 1, 2, and 3 bestseller on Amazon. It's zero calories and not challenging Fever-Tree, but certainly filling a gap in that market. And also I'm investing in non-quoted companies. There's about 9 other companies I'm involved in. So yeah, there's plenty of things and opportunities out there to take my time, but obviously and to enjoy speaking to you, Tamsin, and all your lovely clients.
Thank you. So I have one more question. So if anybody else has any other questions, do type them in. So Rebecca Stewart has a question. She says you spoke about the increasing number of instruments being traded in the market. So where do you see the role of the market maker in the future?
I think the role of the market maker is ever more important. Certainly, I think since MiFID II, certainly in the smaller arena, as I mentioned earlier, I think there's a two-tier market, I believe, where it's highly liquid, which one of your clients said earlier, that can trade freely on the order book. Where I think the smaller company really to a great degree was overlooked. The reason Winterflood Securities evolved was because we believed that the smaller company and also the regional brokers were very much overlooked. We believe that the investment banks, the large investment banks, were chasing the large institutional corporates or the FTSE 100 and some of the 250s, but really weren't interested in the smaller companies. Now, you know, acorns grow into oak trees. Now you've seen that with ASOS and Fevertree are great examples where they're fantastic companies that have grown from strength to strength to strength. So our view was really to aid those companies and to, in many cases, invite those companies in to see how the price was formulated, to see how our thought process. We had a fantastic analyst called Lawrence Marsh, who was a fountain of all knowledge, really. There was nothing worth knowing that he didn't know. And he had a great relationship where we said to the companies, you know, come in, see us, let's explain the mechanics of trading and market making, and we would like to assist you to grow because, you know, they could be the next FTSE 100 company. And it was a certain area that we put a lot of time and effort in. And basically, we expanded organically, really to what the client base wanted. We didn't develop an instrument and then try to force it upon the broker. We said to the broker, what do you want? And I think today's world of investors are very sharp. I mean, Leon, I think, is excellent, and you know, his knowledge of companies is fantastic. And a lot of people with the Google and looking on things and SIPs and ICES and what was formerly PEPs are far more aware. But it's quite sad, I think, how that smaller cap arena and smaller cap companies really have been forgotten about. And really with MiFID II, and that's really happened again. And I think the market maker and some of the corporate brokers are really doing their bit to support the UK PLC, growing UK PLC.
I've got another question from James Coulson, who's asking about your thoughts on level two for retail traders or retail investors.
In what respect?
Do you think it's worth it? What are your thoughts about level two? Do you use level two?
No, I don't use level two. I'm old fashioned. I phone up my broker and I quiz him of everything I can. That's where I go. I'm literally have got a 15-minute delay on Vox and Bloomberg, and I just extremely boring, and then look inside out on Google and read everything then. But no, I just speak to my broker.
So you wouldn't advocate that investors use level two?
No. Well, not, it's certainly it's not for me, but that's a personal preference.
And a final question from John Birchall: don't you miss the cut and thrust of market making?
Yes, I miss the banter, certainly. Yes, it's in your blood, isn't it? It's in your DNA. So yes, the times of old. I had some. I still have got some excellent friends. I worked with an amazing team, and I was very, very fortunate to work with probably, in my view, the best team there was in the city. In that respect, I'm very, very fortunate, and many of them are still very good friends to this day.
Spencer, many, many thanks indeed.
My pleasure.
If you want an email notification of webinars or PI World events, please sign up under the events box on the right-hand side of the homepage at PI World. There are actually two boxes. The top is signing up for a notification of a new video as it's published, and the second down is sign up for events. And they're different lists, no spam. Please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards, and YouTube. We like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting good speakers relies on the audience number that we attract. And it's also nice to get the feedback to hear what you're liking or what you're not liking. Anyway, many thanks to you all for joining us and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.